In this second part of our interview with award-winning author and journalist Keith McCafferty, he offers survival tips when confronting mountain lions or bears, his experiences as a survival journalist in the wilds of Montana, hints about his next book, a Cain and Abel story set on the Smith River, which is threatened by a multinational corporation wanting to put a mine there, the business side of writing, the differences between literary fiction, thrillers, and mysteries, as well as life as a working journalist, from his first job as a crime reporter for a newspaper in Bakersfield, California, to Field & Stream magazine, and on to writing a novel every year in the Sean Stranahan mystery series set outside the fictional town of Bridger, in a fictional Madison County, which shares many features of his own hometown, Bozeman, Montana. And now, Keith McCafferty.
You have written so much about survival. There are mountain lions throughout California, and sure. Mothers are terrified.
They've caused probably at least 3 fatalities in the past 15 years, and a couple that have not been proven that it was a cat, but a very good chance.
I would like you to share how to survive.
Different species are different. Black bears very rarely attack human beings, but when they do, it is often unprovoked, and they actually are trying to kill somebody to eat. So playing dead is really not a good strategy against a black bear attack. Grizzly bears, most of their attacks are territorial, whether they're protecting cubs or kill or whatever, and they are often content to simply render the intruder not dangerous, in other words, lying on the ground and leave. And in those cases, playing dead, rolling on your stomach, placing your hands behind your head, trying not to let the bear flip you, that can work, and the bear can leave you alone sometimes. Not everything works every time. Lions are very hesitant to attack you head on. Lions are very good-natured cats. Bobcats are much feistier than lions. If bobcats were the size of lions, there would be a lot more controversy over them. Lions really don't want to do anything but be left alone and eat deer. But the problem is we are moving into their habitat, especially in the river valleys. And what happened, the dynamic there, is that male lions push subadult lions, especially other male lions, to the extremities of the habitat. And so you have young male lions living in areas adjacent to where people are living, summer people, and they see them on an everyday or every week basis. And at some point, it may click that this is a possible choice of food. And in a few cases, they have attacked and killed and eaten people. It's almost always the young male. If you are confronted by a lion deeper into the mountains, it is typically a female simply because that's the most likely lion you're going to come across. Lions are not used to what they're attacking fighting back, so the recommendation always is to fight back. I interviewed one guy who beat one off with a fishing rod that was called an ugly stick. It's a brand of fishing rod. And I told this guy, I said, you know, you should contact the makers of the ugly stick and they'll use you in a, you know. I was able to fend off an attacking lion with my fishing rod. I like lions and I love tigers. I was lucky enough to work in India and write about tigers. I've seen quite a few lions, mountain lions, you know. I think I'm up to 9 now. And I've been confronted by 2 at night. I wrote a story about that for Field & Stream as well.
2 at the same time?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's very unusual, isn't it?
Well, no, it's not very unusual because a lot of times sub-adults will travel in pairs, whether it's a pair of sisters, a pair of brothers usually, one of those two. Mm-hmm. I am an elk hunter, and I was hunting for meat, basically, on the day before Thanksgiving. And I was up a creek that is called Elkhorn Creek, and I had seen some elk on a big hillside before dark, and I climbed that hillside to see if I could get closer to them and see if there was a bull among them. Anyway, the elk sort of faded out of sight. But what it meant was I was going to be hiking 2 or 3 miles back to my car at night, which I'd done many times before, and I didn't have my headlight on, and I took a cartridge out of the chamber of the rifle because it's more dangerous in the rifle than out of the rifle if you trip or something. I was coming out down towards the river. There's a point where it flows, Elkhorn Creek flows into the Gallatin River. And I turned the corner there and had about a third of a mile to hike back to my car. And I heard a growl in front of me. And my first thought was, it's a grizzly bear and I'm dead. Because I had been run out of the woods by a grizzly bear earlier that year. And that was a terrifying experience. And my second thought was, no, it's one of these trucks changing gears out on the highway across the river. And then it growled again, and of course, mountain lions can't really roar. They're technically small cats. And they have hyoid bones structure, and their throats prevent them from actually roaring. And I immediately knew it was a cat the second time it growled. And it was just no more than 10 feet in front of me and flattened down on the path. And it ran up the hillside, and then it began to pace back and forth, just growling continuously. I had a third of a mile to go, and I was concerned. I wasn't really scared. At a certain point, I turned on my headlight, which made me night blind, which didn't help matters. Mm-hmm. But every time that light would hit the eyes of the cat, they would just glow jade green. So I could, between the continuous growling of the cat and seeing those eyes, I knew right where it was, and I know it's going to follow me all the way. I remember at one point saying, "Get out of here." And it was like a part of me was floating above saying, that didn't sound very convincing, you know.
Did you put the shot back in the...
It took me a long time. I was with the cat for 5 or 10 minutes before I even put a cartridge in the gun. And then I didn't want to... I thought, well, I could shoot up into the air. Maybe it would drive it away. But in cases like in India with tigers, that has brought the tiger down upon people sometimes. So you don't know how they'll react. So far, it had not attacked me. I thought I'd leave well enough alone. And then the growls didn't come as often, and the headlight didn't pick up the eyes as often. And that's when I started to become concerned, because now I didn't know where it was.
Right.
But I knew it was with me. I knew it hadn't left. And so I decided, I'm just going to back down to the river and wade across the river. So I backed down to the river, being very careful not to fall, not to look vulnerable. And then I waded the Gallatin River, and it was ice flowing.
The day before Thanksgiving,
flowing,
yes.
Ice, anchor ice on the bottom. Yeah. I had no idea. I just waded through that river. And when I got to the far bank, I looked back, and I could see that the cat had come down on the bank, and now it looked like there were two cats. But it was, it was dark. It was hard to see. But I thought, that's when I first felt safe. I felt like, well, they're not going to make the commitment to cross that river. Then, for the first time, I became actually afraid. It's funny, you don't know how you react in those situations till you're in them. I was not afraid the entire time I was with the cats. I was concerned, but I wasn't afraid. And now that I felt like they wouldn't make the commitment to swim the river, I became afraid of the situation. And I had so much adrenaline pumping through me that I remember coming to a fence and just kicking it down. I was like one of those women who can pick up the back of a Volkswagen if there's a child under it. And I went back out to the highway, and a trucker picked me up immediately, took me to my car, and then I was afraid to walk the 100 feet to my car. And then I was so excited that I had a problem keeping my foot off the accelerator, because it's a dangerous canyon to drive at night in the winter. But I wanted to go so fast, I was so excited. And so we went down the next day, old Joe Gutkowski and myself and my father and I think my wife Gail. And what had happened was the lions, there were two lions, they had swum the river from west to east. And so what had happened was, as soon as I turned the corner, I had surprised them. And so I had come upon them just as they were coming out of the river. Another thing I learned is they had visited an old elk kill. And had I continued on rather than go down to the river, I would have walked right by the elk kill. Now, would that have triggered them to attack me? I don't know. But I was unaware that the elk kill was there, because when I'd gone hunting early in the morning, it was before daylight, and I'd walked through there without seeing it. So anyway, I've always felt close to mountain lions. And I'd like to have a book that has sort of a theme of mountain lions, but I'm not sure how to do it yet.
Well, you mentioned that you're working on another book now.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us anything about that?
Was
is it bad luck or something?
No, it's sort of a retelling of Cain and Abel, in a sense. People have been encouraging me for several years to write a story that concerns itself with the mining controversy in the Smith River. American Rivers has it ranked as the fourth most endangered river in our country. It is, in my opinion, maybe the most beautiful river in our country, certainly the most beautiful I've ever seen. And it's the hardest drawing to float it, outside the Grand Canyon, and I think maybe the River of No Return stretch of the Salmon in Idaho. So every year, thousands of people, but it's a limited number of people, can draw and float it. And it has come under concern because there is a mining company that is foreign-owned, owned by people in Canada, Australia, different trusts all over Europe. they want to put a copper mine on the major spawning tributary, which contributes, Sheep Creek, which contributes about half the flow to the Smith River. And the irony of it is that the man in charge of the project manager is a geologist. He grew up on a ranch where Sheep Creek enters the Smith River, and he is the one in charge of building this mine. One of the arms of the mine is designed to go underneath Sheep Creek. And the history of hard rock mining in our country, or copper mining, gold mining, silver, all hard rock mining, is basically one disaster after another, with tailage breachings of containers that are supposed to last forever. Because when you extract sulfide minerals in the process of digging copper, those sulfide minerals become exposed to water and air, and they are one of the worst poisons in our country. So I think this man has his heart in the right place. He's trying. I believe him when he's very upfront about other mining disasters, and they're trying to do everything they can. But the truth is, what they're trying to do to prevent disasters in the future is experimental technology. And they're expecting membranes, which are only about an inch thick, to contain poisonous wastes forever, basically. The odds of a tailage leak are fairly high because that's what the history is. The residents of the Smith, on the Smith, the few people who have cabins there all have signs out there, you know, no Smith River mine, hashtag not on my watch. And there's a lot of people who have bumper stickers, save our Smith, and that. So I wanted to write about that. I wanted to set a human story against that backdrop. And I also thought it was interesting to have the vehicle for the story to be floating down a river. The story starts upstream and ends at Eden Bridge, which is a great name, Eden Bridge. And I wanted to have somebody who is sort of like, believes himself to be a caretaker of the river, who builds scarecrows to look down over the river, that he is the watchman of the river. And so I'm trying to pull that all together. And this time, my major character, one of them will be Harold, who I have a lot of readers who would like to see him be more of a major character. And so this story will begin with him, and it will end with him, and he will play a major part. But it's very difficult for me to pull off, and right now I feel like I'm failing. And I just keep telling myself, well, with every other book, it's been the same way. I can do this, but I don't know. Right now, I really feel like I'm failing at it. We'll see. And I've had three books in a row that I've had such good luck with, you know, Crazy Mountain Kiss, Buffalo Jump Blues, and now Cold-Hearted River, that have got wonderful reviews and all this, and think, well, I don't know if I can do this. So you just got to try. Because I'm always trying to write above what my actual level is, and I'm always trying to pull something off that I'm really not sure I can do. I certainly didn't think I could pull off the Hemingway stuff. I had grave doubts about that. But I think I did. I hope I did.
I think you did in all of your books.
The first three are so much in the past now that it's hard for me to think about them.
And I think that there is a change between the first three and the second three. Mm-hmm. The characters have more fully developed. The storylines are getting more complex.
And I'm getting older, and it's harder for me to do that stuff when things become complex.
It's interesting because the finished product seems so polished and graceful. It's very interesting to hear what torment you go through.
Well, that's the plotting stuff. Because I'm an old magazine writer, and before that a journalist for newspapers, I actually was a nightside, like a crime reporter in Bakersfield, California, at one point in my life. I always prided myself in turning things in on time and turning in finished work. So nobody reads this until it's fairly finished, pretty well polished. So, and I sometimes think the difference is that I just work on things harder than some writers. It means a lot to me to have each sentence flow, if I can, almost inevitably from the one above. It makes it more difficult to change things. I can't just rearrange paragraphs or anything. So I sort of take meticulous care with language. And my wife is always telling me, well, you know, how well you write really doesn't matter. And you know, it sort of doesn't in a sense. And I love those reviews that say I can write wonderful prose and all that. But I remember when I had a lunch with Catherine Court, the president and publisher of Penguin, and who's my personal editor. And she said, well, you know, you're really a really good writer, But I realized, well, what she meant by that, the subtext of that is that that's good. That's like a nice bonus. But that's really not necessary. Most people today read for a story.
Well, I'm writing, not one of them.
No, well, I'm not either, but, you know, we're in the minority.
I want you to at least try to balance whatever voices are telling you that and to add my voice saying, no, that's one of the things I really appreciate about writing is how beautifully it flows. And you have talked about emphasis.
And that's not natural talent. I've worked really, really, really hard at that.
Well, good. Yeah. I'm glad you do, and I hope you keep it up. It sort of seems unfair that it's so easy to read and so hard to write.
It's important to me that the books can be read. You can read them quickly, in a sense, that they have good pace.
Well, that's what I did the first time I read them. But in preparing for this and taking notes and all that kind of stuff, I read them far more slowly with the hindsight of having read them all and looking for foreshadowing and that kind of stuff.
Do a little bit of that in
books.
Yeah,
not a whole lot.
Not a whole lot, but I do a little bit of something that might happen in the next book down the road.
You have emphasized your focus on character and plot, but, and since we're talking about prose, many's the time in some books where landscape is being described, that's a real bugaboo. After a while, I'll just skim through that. And I find myself not doing that very much in yours. First of all, you don't lay it on too thick.
And they try to weave it into the actual story as it's moving, rather than just try to set aside two long paragraphs that are nothing but description of something.
And oftentimes, the landscape is almost a character.
My publisher and my agent both remind me of that. They said, always remember that Montana is a character in your books. Mm-hmm. That's very true. My wife was saying, I don't know whether you should set a couple scenes in Michigan or in Cuba. They've identified you with this Montana thing. But the truth is, Cold Hearted River mostly does take place Montana-Wyoming border. But I couldn't help going abroad a little bit. It makes it fun for me.
It's fun to read, too.
Yeah. It's a strange business. It's a very isolating way of working. And so I'm very appreciative when people assure me that I haven't been wasting my time. Like a lot of people, I really never had a choice. I always wanted to be a writer and sort of damn the consequences of that. It's hard for me to tell young people, well, you know, follow your dream but have a backup plan, because I never had a plan B. I was going to make my living as a writer from the start, and I pretty much have, although I've had various other jobs along the way, and especially beforehand. And to me, all writing is sort of a search for the truth, which goes all the way back to when I was a little boy fascinated by snakes. I wanted to find out what the truth was. And so I think that made me gravitate towards mystery books. I don't even like having my books be called mystery books, but they are. I do have a body floating around in every book. I always say the difference between literary fiction and mystery fiction is that one of them has a body and the other one wishes they did. And that is harder to write mystery fiction than I think it is to write literary fiction, than I think it is to write thrillers. Thrillers are different, because in thrillers you know who the bad guys are, and you're in their head. So you basically have good guys on one side, bad guys on the other, and they're running parallel to each other, and at some point they're going to cross. And the best you can hope to do is create tension, because there's no mystery involved. It's much harder to write mystery books where you're trying to find out what happened, but you don't have that gift of being able to go into somebody else's head. So I gravitated towards writing mysteries because they were that search for the truth. But I'm certainly not limited to that. I've always wanted to write a book about growing up in Appalachia. And I wrote about 33,000 words so far. And I've always felt like if I'll ever be known for anything, it will be that. I created an opportunity by writing a book. And that's the first thing that you need to do. And then I had the choice whether to go forward with that opportunity and to make it happen. And I thought, well, you know, I'll never be able to live with myself if I don't take advantage of it, if I don't at least try. So that much I can give myself credit for. I've tried very hard. But you don't get rich in this business. You hear about the people who have, you know, write their first or second book and they become these mega stars. And then it's just not the way it usually is. You really have to persevere, that you're in it for the long haul. For one thing, my publisher probably would have never taken me on if I was only going to write one book, because they can't make any money on one book. The idea is that you have to build a readership with each book, with the exception of the second book, which usually goes into a deep trough of despair, because your first book, at least you had the advantage of being a first-time writer, and the publishing world loves first-time writers. Second-time writers, you're neither new, so you've lost that halo, nor are you established. You're in nowhere land. So that one is a very difficult one to write and also to sell. I got lucky because Oprah Winfrey picked that book up, my second book, and that gave me a little bit of a boost, a little bit of help step out of the gutter with The Grey Ghost Murders, which was my second book. But each book becomes harder to write, and maybe it's because you want to do more with them. I don't know. I think if you're driven to do this, you just have to do it as best you can and keep at it and hope that at some point the book does find the audience it deserves. This book is doing very well. I know it was reprinted, went into a second printing a month before it was ever shipped from the factory, which actually caused some consternation among independent bookstores because they don't want to get second printings of hardcover because they have collectors who want first printings. And the irony is all the first printings go to big places like Barnes & Noble and Costco, and the patrons of those places don't care whether. So anyway, but that's just a business aspect of it. I would encourage people, don't be put off by the idea that I have fishing in the books. It's so small that I could read you all the passages about fishing in 5 minutes.
As each book goes along, there's less and less specific about fishing
right.
in it.
My first book, the actual plot was the Whirling Z stuff, was quite intimately tied into fishing. The first book was The Royal Wolf Murders. And basically, it concerned itself with whirling disease, which is a disease that affects trout, and the deliberate pollution of rivers with whirling disease to create opportunities for investment, basically, among unsavory parties. And the interesting thing about that book to me is this very first book I wrote, and when I first wrote it, I had that idea as sort of the hook for the plot. And then I got to the point where I was going to introduce it. Then I just started writing something else. So I wrote the book, and to make a long story short, when it got to my agent, Dominic Abel, who was not my agent at that point, he said, "This is wonderful. You're a wonderful writer." But when it got to this plot point, he said, I didn't believe that. And it needs to be more organic. It needs." He talks in circles, and sometimes I understand him after a while, but that's his way of sort of finding the nut underneath it. Anyway, I rewrote it with the original plot that I had wanted to do, the Whirling Disease. I didn't follow my instinct to do this because I thought it might be too esoteric or it wouldn't appeal to readers who weren't involved in this kind of trout biology. I'm glad that he told me that the other thing didn't work and that I had to go back and write it. And the interesting thing was, in retrospect, was I didn't get around to rewriting that book because I had two children in college. I had to make a certain amount of money a year, and I was working very hard in the magazine industry. And so about 3/4 of a year passed, and I got a letter from Dominic Abel saying that, as I have not heard back from you, I assume that you've gone in a different direction, and best of luck in the future. And it made me feel really bad. And about a month after that, I found out that I was a finalist for a National Magazine Award. I was flown to New York, got to wear a tuxedo, go to the Lincoln Center, be introduced by Martha Stewart, of all people. I didn't win, but what I found out was the magazine had put me up in a hotel for one night, and directly across the street was Dominic Abel's literary agency. And I didn't have the courage to knock on the door because I had not gone back and rewritten that book. But that gave me the impetus to come back to Montana and to rewrite it with the original story that I wanted to tell, and that ended up being The Royal Wolf Murders. And at that point, I think it was assumed that I would write books that had more of a theme to do with fishing. And I told the powers that be that I didn't really have an interest in that, that it seemed artificial to me, and I wanted to write other stories, and I would still keep a little bit of fishing in them. So I think that's worked out better for the books. I think there still are people who are a little bit hesitant because they think that there's a lot of fishing in them, which there isn't. It's mostly people just interacting in all different ways.
That's the beauty of literature, that it appeals,
right,
and it transcends politics. I think you're successful in that.
Well, I know that if anybody reads my books closely, they'll at least know that, at least in an environmental sense, I do sort of lean to the left. Certainly I'm an environmentalist.
The truth is that most people who want to continue hunting and fishing in the face of the threats to the environments in which you can hunt and fish.
Right.
See, I don't buy it. I don't buy it that that's a left-right issue.
No.
Real conservatives want to protect. It's the corporate takeover of the moniker conservative that has blown that all out of reality.
No, because there's an awful lot of common ground with people who hunt and fish. And that does play a part in politics now, even our own politics in Montana.
Very much so. Public access
issues and all that.
Yeah.
Hal Herring is an environmental writer. He lives up maybe in Helena. That's his life, trying to protect the environment. So that's an interesting thing, is that I'm sort of affiliated with two groups of people. Here I am immersed with this, you know, sort of mystery and literary fiction people on one side. On the other side, I was an outdoor writer for 100 years, and they're completely different people. A number of years ago, not that long ago, 3 or 4 years ago, I was the featured speaker for the Outdoor Writers Association of America, and that was held that year in Lake Placid in New York, and they were going to fly me out, put me up in a fancy hotel, all that stuff. 3 days later, after that started, they had the annual BoucherCon conference, which is the mystery writers and readers. Actually, the fans put it on. Mm. And it's the International Gathering of Mystery. It's the biggest gathering of the year. And it's held in various places. Last year, I went to it in New Orleans because my publisher actually wanted to come spend some time with me, which was very nice. But I went to it first. It was in Albany, New York, which is only 60 miles from where I was staying, the Adirondacks. So I did the thing up in the Adirondacks at Lake Placid. Then I did the BoucherCon, where I was a panelist. And that was fascinating because the outdoor writers are so absorbed politically in saving hunting and fishing opportunities, but mostly saving the environment. And so when, you know, we were eating lunch at one point and these people came in and said, "We killed the pebble mine," which they did. The people who did that were right there with me. And Hal Herring is one of those warriors. These are people who, they just live and breathe and die with what happens to the environment. They're very altruistic, and I'm very much respected as a writer, but I'm not on their level as an environmental writer. I try to keep environmental messages in other kinds of writing. So they need people like me, too. Then you go from there to the BoucherCon people, which are all the mystery people in that. Fiction people, they don't have that. They're nice people, but they're like from a different planet. They don't have a cause like that. But all those outdoor writers, they have a cause, and it's not a selfish cause. And people think, well, they just want to hunt. No, that's not true. They want to save the world. And so it was remarkable, the difference between those groups. And when you're a writer in the fiction world, it's an I, me, mine kind of a business in a sense. You always expected to be, and you are trying to draw attention to yourself. I'm more at home with the outdoor people because they're sort of all on the same page with a goal, whereas the fiction people are trying to make a living out of it. I always tell groups of people that, too. The one reason I like to do things with other writers is it's more fun, because otherwise you're just, you know, you go to these conferences or you go here, there, and you're always trying to just draw people's eyes to you. And I don't really like that part of it as well. To me, it's very apparent because I started as a newspaper journalist. And as a newspaper journalist, especially somebody who writes about crime and death, I knew everybody in Bakersfield. I knew the cops. I knew everybody. And I knew all the stories, and I knew all the stories that weren't printed. It's like you have your finger on the pulse of the city, and you're so closely tied into the city when you're a newspaper reporter. And then I became a magazine writer, and now all of a sudden all I'm doing is maybe talking to my editors in New York once every 2 weeks, or maybe I'm interviewing somebody for something. But a lot of the stuff I wrote was just off the top of my head. All of a sudden you've taken a big step back from being immersed into the world of people like that. Now you sort of step back from that. And when you become a novelist, you step way back and you're very isolated. So it's this weird thing where you sort of remove yourself from people in order to write about them. It's a very strange dynamic that way. And I don't really even know if that's entirely healthy, but it's very apparent. And that's one reason that I just don't work alone at home. It's just too isolating. So I'll work in coffee shops, or I'll work out at the creek, or wherever I'll go. I'll go someplace else, but I won't work at home alone. They ask you when this empty nest syndrome kicks in. Well, it kicks in the day your youngest child goes to college. The second that you come back home, it's quiet. It's just too quiet for me. Every writer is different, and some writers, you know, they demand that isolation and quiet, or, you know, they got that little broom closet they go into.
A room of one's own, Virginia Woolf.
Well, that's fine, but, you know, some people like that. But first of all, if you're a newspaper writer like I was, you don't need to be coddled as much. I can write anywhere at any time.
So you're able to concentrate on writing at Wild Joe's?
Absolutely.
See, that's,
I've written
to
whole
me amazing.
Books there at various. Wild Crumb, I was there this morning. One trick I have is these are progressive lenses, which most people my age have some form of corrective thing. So with this, I can read, I can type, and I can see everything clearly. I don't want to wear these when I work. So I will wear regular reading glasses that are prescription, but they're just reading. That way, everything beyond here is a tiny bit fuzzy.
Yeah. But what about sound?
I am able to tune that out. So I have people swirling around me, talking, background music usually in most places, and I am able to tune that out and work. I'm not alone in that, but, you know, there's other people who are like that too. I can write at home if I have to now. Or sometimes something will be so pressing that I just have to do it.
You have to get it down, yeah. How long have you been married to Gil?
Well, let's see. Okay. I've been married about 36, I think. She was the education reporter at the Bakersfield Californian.
Oh, that's so when you met in Bakersfield.
I actually was a graduate student at the University of Michigan, and I was deemed the graduate student who was, believe it or not, the most responsible that they could trust with this internship in California, which they just got. So I went out there as an intern, and that's when I met Gail as an intern at the newspaper. The head of the department with Charles Eisendrath, the head of the graduate program at the University of Michigan, and he took me because he liked people who would amuse him. He thought I would amuse him. This idea of somebody who would, like, go fishing or hunt white-tailed deer with a muzzleloader and then come into class at 9 a.m. having already hunted deer out at the Pinckney Recreation, he just thought this was bizarre because he was an urbane Jewish man, you know, that's like, it was like a different species.
And Appalachian, too.
Yeah. And he was, and he was, you know, he'd been the Time bureau chief in London, Buenos Aires, Lisbon, and was a very well-known journalist in his day. So the funny thing was that years later, 20 years later, 25 years later, I was listening to National Public Radio, and they had an interview with Charles Eisendrath, and he was talking about the good aspects of hunting for your own food. Because he thought that this was just the most bizarre thing in the world. Somebody who goes hunting, he couldn't believe it.
Have you read Hillbillyology?
Well, I've read parts of it because, you know, it touches upon how I grew up.
Well, that's what I
wondered. This guy was from farther west in Ohio than I was. And he wasn't really in Appalachia. But
no,
he writes
but
about it.
His family came from the Kentucky part of
But I was, I grew up in deepest Appalachia in certain regards. In fact, parents or people would take people on drives to see the hillbillies living in, to see rural Appalachia, mm-hmm. people sleeping in cars or just shacks, squatting on played out coal company lands. Mm-hmm. And they all talk Southern. We called it talking Southern. And some of my relatives did too. They had these mm-hmm. very strong accents. And here we were all the way up in Ohio, but you would think you were in Tallahassee, Florida or something by the way people spoke. That was very depressing in a way, though. And they all played country music, and it was just amazing. You know, it was like in a whole little subculture. Where I grew up, if you went like in one hollow, because I grew up in, it's in the mountains, you're in the mountains mm-hmm. there. In one hollow, there might be a little white chapel and a few nice little homes. And you go into the next hollow, and it's just dead chickens in the creek and people that all look like they're from Deliverance. Mm-hmm. And the next one will be the little white chapel. So it wasn't everywhere, but it was sure there. And my dad would always tell me, well, he would do anything he could for me as long as I got out of there, mm-hmm. as long as I left. And I left. But, and I worked in the steel mills, too. Did you ever see The Deer Hunter, the movie? The first scenes are shot in the 44-inch mill, the steel mill where I worked. Mm-hmm. And my cousin, Billy McCafferty, my father's brother's son, he's the police chief of Steubenville, Ohio now. And Steubenville, Ohio, you might recall, a couple years ago became infamous for the football player rapes, because they carried a girl like a dead deer, and it was on social media, and that's what made it.
Well, they filmed.
Yeah, right. You have a town that's 15,000 people with a football stadium that holds 10,000 people. Mm-hmm. Football is God, mm-hmm. and that coach was actually threatening reporters that he would find their loved ones and kill them. So the journalists were threatened who came into town to report about it. My cousin Billy was sort of caught in the middle of it. He's the police chief. And the only reason he was the police chief is because Steubenville was such a corrupt place that it was one of only two towns in the entire United States under a certain kind of law enforcement mandate for police brutality and corruption.
And so Department of Justice?
Yeah, they had an oversight mm-hmm. on Steubenville. There was only two towns. And part of their decision-making was that they would, of course, fire the police chief, and they would bring in a new police chief from out of state. Couldn't be from anywhere. But they made my cousin the police chief in interim. Almost 17 years later, he's still the police chief. And he was on the Dr. Phil show and Good Morning America. He was in the New York Times. And so I actually talk to him sometimes when I'm writing a book, because he's considered to be one of the most experienced police chiefs in the nation. When he goes to these schools, he'll go to this further training, and there'll be like a half a dozen guys there like him that everybody looks up to, because he's seen more than almost any police chiefs do, especially in towns that size, mm-hmm. because they've dealt with so much. And he'll say, if he could just get rid of 80 people, he could clean this town mm-hmm. up. Because our town, this 15,000 people, is run by, there is a Steubenville Mafia, and there is the Chicago Mafia. Before that, there was a Detroit Mafia, and then there were also times when there was no Mafia at all. But going way back to the 1920s and 30s, there was the Detroit Mob, the Chicago Mob, then nothing. Now we're back to having the Chicago Mob. What do they want with a town of 15,000 people? It's drug trafficking. There's a TV show called Justified. The first episode was the only one that was shot on location. That first episode, which is a great episode, was shot about 30 miles from where I grew up. And you see the kind of Appalachia that it really is. And all the subsequent episodes were shot in Southern California. Mm-hmm. And that's very much what I grew up with, except then it was mostly just stills. It wasn't until mm-hmm. drugs came back in the valley that the various mobs got associated, came back in again. This is a really bad place, and pollution was incredible. They used to sell T-shirts in Steubenville that said we're number one on them, with a smokestack on it, because the Environmental Protection Agency had deemed Steubenville to be the dirtiest city in America in terms of parts per million particulate matter for 10 years in a row. And that's all from the steel mills. So when I'd work at the steel mill, I'd wake up in the morning and the radio would say that the pollution index was so high that don't leave your homes if you can, or just go directly to business. And I'd be going down to the steel mill. You couldn't see across the street, and I'd go down into the steel mill. Now those steel mills are all gone. They're all working at 6% capacity or 2%. Mm-hmm. They're still there, but they don't do anything. They were obsolete even back when I was working there, because they were all built between 1900 and 1910. So when people would say, well, we lost our coal industry to Japan, as if Japan took it from us. No, those people actually worked. When I would work, the people with seniority, a lot of them, they didn't even go to the mill. They just have somebody punch in the time card and punch it out. So you had 10 people to do every one person's job, because it was entirely mafia run. And it was run largely by Catholic Italian-Americans and the Democratic Party. They used to say that the most powerful person in Steubenville, it wasn't the mayor, or anything, it was whoever was the head of the Democratic Party. So it was one of those cases where the Democrats, they were the corrupt people in power in that particular instance. And it's just a horrible place. I mean, it's good for stories. I didn't work in the coal mines, but I went down in the coal mines with my Uncle George. One of the things I want to write about is the mountaintop removal mining there. There were two mountaintop removal sites within 5 miles of where I grew up, where they basically are destroying. That's the oldest mountain range in the world.
The Appalachians.
That's the oldest in the world. Yeah. Although it's not universally regarded to be there, they're generally regarded to be the central Appalachians, where also the tallest mountains in the world, much higher than Everest.
Several billion years ago.
Several billion years
ago, right.
And they're just blowing the tops off them. So that's what I really want to write about, and I still will. But it's hard, you know. It's hard to contract to write a book a year. Well, I'll have a contract up with this next book, and we'll see what happens.
That just seems so hard, a book a year. That's a lot of pressure.
They sort of demand it. It is a lot of pressure, but it's sort of what you sign on for, because that's the way they build readership, and Americans have short attention spans. And you find out, if you go a year without doing a book, if several things happen. First is people get mad at you. First, they get upset that you don't have a book coming out. And then I'll even, like, I got a reader who complained to me last week that I was his favorite writer in the country, but I had fallen out of favor because it was too long to wait between the publication of the hardback and the soft cover, which is all he could afford. Now, my books are pretty much like most people's books. They come out in hardcover. About a year later, they come out in softcover. But no, to him, that was too long to wait. So readers get mad at you, or they tend to, at some point, forget about you. You know, what happened to this guy? Why isn't he publishing? So they expect to see that book every year. They'd like to see it once every 6 months. In order to build readership, they want you to produce the book a year. The upside of it is that there are some writers who lock themselves in a hole in the ground and take 7 years to write a book. Now, psychologically, that can't be good for you. One thing that's good about publishing one book a year is that, first, there's a publication season, and that's sort of an exciting time. Then there's an award season, comes 6 months later, and that's sort of an exciting time. And you always have two books in the mix.
The hardback and the soft.
And it's usually the soft cover that's up for the literary awards, mm-hmm. because it has to be the whole previous year.
Right.
So right now, like the Will Rogers Medallion Award, that's for, not for Cold Hearted River, that's for Buffalo John Blues. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Between the spring awards and the fall awards and publication, you are involved. You know, you're not just out there by yourself. And you're also corresponding with readers all the time. And so that actually is a big pick-me-up. Anybody who writes to me, and on my website, I encourage people to write to me. Anybody who writes to me, I write back to mail and postcards. And I do that with hundreds of people. And so you find out that that's sort of fun. Because it used to be, I didn't expect that, because as a magazine writer, my work actually reached more people.
Right.
And they would impress upon me that any single article I wrote reached more people than John Cheever did is an entire lifetime.
Really?
Just one article, because it had 13 million readers.
Mm-hmm.
13 million readers. A substantial number would turn to a page I was on.
Mm-hmm.
That was sort of interesting. But the magazine stood between you and the readers.
Mm-hmm.
So the readers didn't really get in touch with me a lot. And the ones who did were often incarcerated. They were often, because they had nothing to do better to do. And I learned my lesson early on, you don't really correspond with those people, because they all want you to get their sentences reduced or use your expertise to somehow get them out of prison. It'd be ludicrous, you know, somebody who embezzled money. What do I know about that? So you know you're not dealing with ordinary people. But you didn't have any connection to the readers, or very little connection. Now with the books, you have a lot of direct connection to them. So I'm constantly involved with readers. And that keeps you going. It sort of keeps you sane. And also, if I get one or two little pieces of fan mail a day, and it ranges from zero to five or six, you know, but almost every day I get something. Almost every day. A lot of times it's new people, and sometimes it's the same person. You know, they'll write back and forth to me 10 times over 5 years. That sort of brightens your day. And what's basically a very isolating experience.
I don't contact authors unless it's to do an interview, because I have always thought it would be bothering them. It would be like, well, that's what I'm hearing you say.
Because they live a life of isolation. They
well, it makes sense
relish
now.
It. Yeah, it keeps you from just sort of like sinking into despair.
I guess it's like coming from Stephen King movies, you know, the one about the fan that went crazy.
Yeah.
That Kathy Bates.
So far, I don't have one
yeah.
of those.
Yeah, I hope you never do.
So I was in British Columbia. This is back before cell phones. And I was on a fishing trip. And I called my wife from a payphone just to let her know I was alive. And she said, well, you know, Field and Stream called, and they really want you to do something. Can you call them? So the next day, I called Field and Stream magazine, you know, using Canadian coins or whatever. And they said, well, they would really like me to write an article about, or story, about some place that meant a lot to me growing up, or some little slice of life. It didn't have to have too much to do with fishing, but something outdoors. And can you get it to me tomorrow? Okay. Well, I found somebody who would like fax something off, and I did it on a manual typewriter in about an hour. And I had an idea for the story. When I was 10 years old, my parents, which usually took us to stay in Michigan, as we've talked about, they took me and my little brother on a camping trip to Maine. And we went to this campground called Sunrise Shores on the Bay of Fundy, which is where it sees the first sunlight in the morning. And this campground was run by this man and this woman, and it had just opened. We were their very first customers. And they had a little girl who was 2 years, or a year and a half younger than me. Her name was Becky. Her name was Becky Titcomb. And her parents said one of the reasons they bought this campground is because they didn't like snakes. And I immediately found 5 or 6 snakes living in their foundation. And anyway, I spent this sort of idyllic 5 or 6 days with Becky all the time, this little blonde-haired girl who I had a crush on. It was the first time, I think, that I became interested in girls, in a sense. So I spent all this time with her, and then, of course, I never saw her again. Well, what happened was, years later, her parents still knew my parents sort of vaguely. And my parents had taken another trip there, but I wasn't on that trip. Becky sent me her high school photograph, a black and white photograph, you know, like a little high school graduation thing. I hadn't seen her since she was 9 years old, and I was 10. And I put this little photograph in my wallet with some other photographs of other people. And this friend of mine is at Duke University, where I went to college, he saw that wallet, and he said, that's the most beautiful girl in the world. And I told him, well, that's Becky Titcomb, and I'd stayed at her parents' campground when I was a little kid, and I hadn't talked to her for years, you know. I'll never forget him saying that. And so we went home for, like, spring break or something, and I got a phone call in Ohio, where I lived, and it was this kid. And he said, turn on the TV, Becky Titcomb is Miss Maine. So I turned on the TV, and there's Becky Titcomb in her little gown or whatever, and she's Miss Maine. She was Miss Maine. So I wrote the story, and I called it Miss Maine, and I wrote about that little period of my life. I used her real name. I was young and innocent then. Well, about a month later, I get a call from one of my editors at Field and Stream, says, there's this woman named Becky Titcomb who would like to get in touch with you. And I thought, oh, no, you know. What had happened was Becky Titcomb lives in north of Massachusetts now, and her husband is a doctor. And some patient had come in, and he'd been leafing through Field & Stream magazine, and he saw this story, and he brought it into the doctor, and he said, "Isn't this your wife?" So I was scared to death to call her, because they won't give out my name, you know, or my number. Mm-hmm. I had to call her, and I was scared to death. They'd sue me, you know, for writing this little thing about when we were little kids together. But no, it was interesting to her. She hadn't thought about me for 100 years. But she did send me her high school picture. So now she's a pen pal of mine. Uh-huh. And we correspond once or twice a year, a couple times a year. I haven't seen her since she was 9 years old, but I still talk to her once or twice a year. So that's my Becky Titcomb story. But that shows you how you have to be careful, because it will get back to you, you know.
Well, I look forward to reading it. I really do. And I thank you so much for being so generous with your time today.
Oh, well, thank you.